Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Jonathan Bennett joins me. We're going to be talking about software bill of materials through Cyclone DX. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Jonathan Bennett. Episode 528, recorded May 1st, 2019, Cyclone DX. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by DigitalOcean. Deploy and scale your app seamlessly on the simplest cloud platform. Join over 150,000 businesses that use DigitalOcean. Sign up today and receive a free $100 credit at do.co/twit. And by IT Pro TV, providing effective training with access to virtual labs and practice tests. Visit go.itpro.tv/floss to take advantage of their lowest price of the season. For an additional 30% off the lifetime of your active subscription, use the code FLOSS30 at checkout. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, libre, open source software. I'm your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at Stonehenge.com, bringing you each week the movers, the shakers, the big projects, little projects, and even sometimes not project. Well, projects, but not software projects. Well, sort of software projects. Now I'm starting to sound like that guy from Green Acres. I'm going to stop right there. Let's go ahead and bring on our co-host, our lovely talented co-host, Jonathan Bennett. Jonathan, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Randall. It's good to be here.
Cool, cool. And you're in the still in the Oklahoma City that you've been in for many, many years?
Yes, but not Oklahoma City. We actually have one of those. I am in Lawton, Oklahoma.
Lawton, Oklahoma. Okay. And I am once again in my condo in Seaside, Oregon. So I'm down here enjoying the weather and taking advantage of the fact that it's walking distance to all the restaurants that I want to go to near here and basically having a great time of spending the week down here. So, and slightly limited bandwidth. So if it drops out occasionally, please bear with us. We'll just hope it all, I'm crossing my fingers, hoping it'll all work out. So today we have an interesting project. We're actually bringing back a guest that was on just about a year ago. Steve Springett, and he was on about a year ago talking about the OWASP dependency track, and he's going to be talking about something similar today, but a little more specific, which is Cyclone DX. Cyclone DX is a lightweight software bill of materials specification designed for use in application security context and supply chain component analysis. For those of you who had the bingo card, I think you probably filled your first row already. So a lot of keywords there, a lot of jargon there. What do you know about this so far, Jonathan?
I know the whole supply chain of software is kind of hot news right now. In fact, I just did a security roundup over at Hackaday, just finished writing it. And one of the big things in, I think it was actually last week's, but the attacks on, who was it? Well, CCleaner was the one. But anyway, where someone, you know, a malicious actor gets a hold of some upstream server and slips a little bit of malware into like a library or an application that's being used. Oh, it was ASUS. It was the ASUS updater. And right. So then suddenly these people started going, well, why is ASUS offering me this update? But it's signed. I guess it's okay. Well, come to find out, it was an update that had malware slipped into it. And so that is kind of the supply chain attack. When you can't attack someone directly, you attack someone upstream from them. And I'm really interested to hear if our guest today has solutions for that, and you know, kind of what he's looking at to be able to maybe combat those attacks.
Yeah, and Stephen wrote me immediately after the show I did, I think about 6 or 7 weeks ago, that was about some closed source software, which is really embarrassing that we put them on Floss Weekly, but some closed source software that looks at things like what we're going to be talking about today, the bill of materials for various pieces of software, to see what's upstream, what might have vulnerabilities, what might have licensing issues, things like that. So he wrote me immediately and said, we should probably do like an open source version of that show. I said, that sounds like a wonderful, wonderful plan. So that's why Steve's on the show today. And anything else before we get started?
If they were the problem, then hopefully Steve is the cure, right?
We'll see. But before we bring Steve on, I do have an important message, because this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by DigitalOcean. Easily run production applications with DigitalOcean, a scalable compute platform with add-on storage, security, and monitoring capabilities. We make it simple to launch in the cloud and scale up as you grow, whether you're running one virtual machine or 10,000. Spin up your choice of a virtual machine in just 55 seconds. Standard, general purpose, or CPU optimized configurations provide flexibility to build, test, and grow your application. DigitalOcean is designed for developers and operators. Over 2,000 open source tutorials are available. The easy to use control panel and API lets developers spend more time coding and less time managing their infrastructure. Use Kubernetes to improve availability, scalability, and resource efficiency of containerized apps. On DigitalOcean's marketplace, deploy pre-configured one-click applications, including LAMP, Docker, GitLab, Jenkins, Plesk, cPanel, WordPress, and many more. Secure and control the traffic to your applications with your own private network, virtual private cloud, traffic filtering, and load balancing. Industry-leading price-to-performance offers flexible server configurations sized for any application, predictable pricing that is the same across all regions and usage volumes, and included at no additional cost. Cloud firewalls, monitoring and alerts, team accounts, full DNS management, 99.99% uptime SLA, 12 global data centers. That means you'll have the connectivity and redundancy you need to provide the best service to your customers. 24/7, 365, world-class support. DigitalOcean is trusted by over 1 million developers. Go to do.co/twit today, sign up, and receive a free $100 credit. That's do.co/twit for a free $100 credit. DigitalOcean, designed for developers, built for businesses. And we thank DigitalOcean for their support of Floss Weekly. Well, let's go ahead and bring on our guest. Steve, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Randall. Appreciate it.
And where are you speaking to us from?
I am in my house in Chicago. I work from home. I've been working from home for about 8+ years. So I've got my my home little office here that I work out of.
Awesome, awesome. Well, wave in your general direction, sort of over that way. So there we go. So tell us, how did this project, CycloneDX, get started, and what has it achieved so far?
That's a great question. So CycloneDX actually started out as a very, very simple bill of material specification and format, basically a way for organizations to document the third-party and open-source components that are bundled in the thing that they're building, right? So very, very simple. And I created a separate little project for it, independent of what I was actually working on at the time, which was OWASP Dependency Track. And so most of my focus has been on Dependency Track, but it's really been interesting over the last year and a half. There's been a lot more focus on bill of materials. And I'm participating in some working groups and some other efforts specifically around software bill of materials as a way to document, again, what all the third-party components that you have in your application, where they derive from, the copyright, the license, you know, everything about it, who made it, what it is, the version, etc. There's been a lot of focus on the software bill of material as of late.
And I think there's something called, was it SPDIF or something, SPDF? I forget the actual letters.
SPDX. SPDX is a specification by the Linux Foundation. SPDX is actually two different things. SPDX is both a list of open source licenses. So there's over 2,000 or more open source licenses that exist today. And SPDX has cataloged roughly about 400 of those, I think. Mm-hmm. So they've classified, whether something is OSI approved, all the license text to those licenses, etc. And SPDX also defines a bill of material specification, which again, what is in the software that I'm making. So if Red Hat or some Linux distribution is shipping these thousands of things in the Linux distro, or if an application is shipping all these third party components and whatever that they're delivering, you can use SPDX to do that as well. So it's two different things that kind of complement one another. And when I created Cyclone DX, I actually looked at the what exists in the market today, right? And mm-hmm. hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of organizations use SPDX license IDs, right? Everybody uses them. If you're publishing packages to NPM or PyPI or NuGet, you're actually using SPDX license IDs. But I didn't really their bill of material specification was a little robust, very heavyweight, and didn't actually do what I needed it to do. I needed something very lightweight, something very adoptable, and could be easily deployed by any organization, and I needed it to be very simple. So I created Cyclone DX to kind of fill that gap. And again, I did it as kind of this one little side project because my main focus was on dependency track. But again, as of late, bill of materials, for whatever reason, well, there's a lot of reasons, but it has really been gaining in popularity. I'm part of there's multiple government initiatives around this effort. I'm part of one in the U.S. government, for example, the National Telecommunications Infrastructure Administration. No, I'm not going to speak on behalf of them, but they're a small little part of the U.S. Department of Commerce, and they're trying to, in a very open, transparent kind of way, trying to get a bunch of stakeholders together and define exactly what software bill of materials mean, what it looks like. So I'm part of those working groups. There's a lot of industry behind that as well. Big software companies, OWASP is there. I'm representing OWASP. But there's, you know, people from government, NSA, Department of Defense, CERT, Linux Foundation, etc., are all part of this effort. And that's just for the U.S. It's not U.S. specific, but there's other governments around the world also talking about software bill of materials.
Yeah, and then I noticed on the Software Bill of Materials page on Wikipedia, my favorite place to research things, except I get distracted a lot. I keep clicking on many, many more links, so it's kind of scary. But the last paragraph on that page there says, the Cyber Supply Chain Management and Transparency Act of 2014 is pending. Well, it's probably dead now. It's not pending anymore. Requires government agencies to obtain software bill of materials for any new products they purchase, which would be really cool to make sure that, you know, at least our government understands the pieces of what's going into their stuff. Is that the kind of thing you're trying to move forward?
Absolutely, absolutely. There's a lot of supply chain risk. I created a wiki article on OWASP, OWASP.org. If you do a search on the site for component analysis, you'll get to the wiki article. But there's about a dozen or so things that a lot of organizations actually care about. Now, if you're government, you're going to care about a lot more. But it's basically having an inventory, right? Just knowing what you're actually shipping is obviously the first step. But simple things like knowing the quantity of components, the type of components, what function does it serve? Does it have any known vulnerabilities in it? Is it the latest version? Is it outdated? Is it end of life and the support? These types of things we can actually derive, we can actually analyze if we had an accurate software bill of material.
Yeah, and these days that's really important because nobody writes code all the way back down to the metal these days. I mean, you're using some version of Linux, you're using some libraries from third parties, you're using code you wrote in-house, code that may have varying licenses, code that may be various versions and maybe even back rev because you don't have a way to update something. And this is why it's important to have a good bill of materials, right?
Absolutely. Knowing what you have and being able to prove that you have what you think you have is very, very important for supply chain vigilance. A lot of efforts are being put in place by governments, and I know financial services are starting to adopt a lot of the supply chain mentality. Unfortunately, we still live in a environment in which the leading market research firms continue to have this vertical that doesn't actually describe the problem. So a lot of the commercial offerings, unfortunately, are creating solutions that that the analysts like, but don't actually attack the actual supply chain risk itself. And I'm trying to go after that because I think that's a lot more important than peasing analysts.
And I do want to say also that two paragraphs up in that same Wikipedia page, it says many companies are using Microsoft Excel for BOM management. No.
Yeah, no. I would run the other direction. So it's one interesting thing. I started to notice this in a former employer, and I've talked to other folks who've also seen this. But organizations that are able to create a automated software bill of material from any build that they have represent a certain level of maturity in their CI/CD pipeline, right? If you're able to do this in an automated way, that means you have a certain level of maturity. If you are an organization that cannot do this or cannot provide a bill of material in any way, that signifies a less mature development process, but it also means that as an organization, if I'm trying to purchase something that you're offering and you can't provide me a bill of material, I know that my operational costs are now going to be significantly more because now I have to do your job for you. Anytime a new vulnerability comes out, I have to monitor your own application because mm-hmm. I don't trust you to actually know what you have in your own software.
Yeah. Also, as I was reading through the website this morning, I noticed a key phrase I thought was pretty good, that the format you're designing has to be both human parsable and machine parsable easily by both.
Yeah. I thought that was key. So again, there are other specifications out there, and some of which are really, really complicated, very heavyweight with a lot of capabilities. But if you want to be able to have a machine-readable format that that can be easily parsed and created through automation through package managers, but you'd still want the ability to glance at it just really quickly and being able to decipher what it actually means, that means that you have to have a schema that is both robust and flexible yet simple enough to make it human readable.
Hey, Steve, I wanted to jump in if I can real quick and ask a question about maybe if we can back up just a little bit and make sure we're bringing everybody along that we understand kind of the foundation of what we're talking about. Bill of materials, so I'm assuming it's this is the application we're shipping. Here are all the libraries that are included with it that we rely on. And it's a way to track that so that everybody that uses the application, like everybody that maintains the application, knows exactly what libraries they're relying on. Is that what this is for?
That's exactly what this is for. So some of the things that the bill of material format does today, Cyclone DX does today, publisher, copyright. If there's a higher level group organization, it'll do that. The name of the component, the version of the component, any license information. For example, if there's a license, if you have to have a choice between two different licenses, or if you have to accept multiple licenses, it'll do that case as well. It supports the package URL specification as well. You had the author of that on your show about 2 years ago, I think it was. But it also does more supply chain type of things as well. For example, it does pedigree. So if I have a fork of a fork of a fork and I modify that fork, well, what is the original thing that I started with? Does that have any risk in it? and what are my modifications, so I can actually track all of those changes throughout my supply chain. So that's really important to be able to maintain and to have the same kind of fidelity in terms of license compliance, known vulnerabilities, outdated, etc. But that pedigree information is really, really important. It also does some other interesting things. For example, I can I can represent components in assemblies and subassemblies. For example, if you looked at a parts catalog, right, and maybe it's a dashboard. This is an analogy I use all the time. A dashboard, right? You're going to have an assembly, a dashboard, and then you're going to have a subassembly. Maybe it's the instrument panel, right? So you can kind of break it down that way as well. And then we're also working on a simultaneous view, so you can also get your dependency tree in that view as well. So it's basically, think of the package manager as basically where you start, and then the repository you're going to gain a lot of information from, like who made it, the copyright, the license, etc., things that the package manager typically doesn't know about. And you combine all this metadata into a pretty robust software bill of material that you can then analyze for various types of risk.
Now, Steve, I imagine this is different based on the kind of different applications and even programming languages. So when somebody writes a Java application, there's this tendency to take just all of their different jar libraries and stuff them into what gets shipped. And so you have kind of static libraries, which really important to keep track of because there's vulnerabilities found in those libraries. It's a very different problem than if you've got a C application that depends upon all of the libraries that are already on the system. Is that kind of a challenge when you have those different mindsets from different languages?
It is. It is very much so. The C world is very, very complicated. Because for the most part, you have a lot of unmanaged dependencies. You have a lot of native code. And when you're doing things manually, as you have to do with C, having the bill of material checked into version control side by side to where your code is would probably be a wise thing to do to keep track of that. But that's a really hard problem to solve. I've recently started looking at Go and Golang as well and their module system, and unfortunately I just think they're kind of moving the opposite way. Everything is decentralized. There's not a lot of authority. There's not a lot of ways to verify what you think you got is actually what you got. I think Go, at least for the time being, is probably a step in the wrong direction. There are some improvements being made to Go this year, but C and some of these other languages, it's a little bit more complicated, for sure.
So, is there any functionality built into this to, in a cryptographic sort of way, confirm that you have what you think you have, like package signing, library signing?
Yeah. So the specification itself, there's implementations for Java. It supports Maven. It supports NPM, PyPI for Python, and .NET. So there's a .NET core module. So if you've got an ecosystem that's not supported, or if you want to contribute to one of the existing implementations, obviously, pull requests and everything else is contributions is certainly welcome, but the specification itself is very extensible. So it supports XML signature, for example. You could create a bill of material and then sign that, and then ship that off to your downstream or upstream suppliers.
Mm-hmm. Sure, makes sense. And then what about? Problems with, so in the introduction, I mentioned the issue with ASUS and their updater. Is this something that's kind of strictly for open source software, or is there an application that could be made for people that are using closed source stuff in their software stack?
You know, the supply chain is really an interesting problem. You've got operational security, you've got, you know, more transparency and bill of material type aspects. There's a lot of things that you need to do to really have a hardened supply chain. And that's just the cyber supply chains. It's a lot more complicated with physical supply chains. But the software bill of material specification that I'm working on and the implementations thereof would certainly be one part of that particular solution. If they had a software bill of material so that they knew exactly what was going in there, that might have reduced the possibility of that particular attack occurring. But again, there's operational security. There's all kinds of other things that you need to do to really have a hardened supply chain. But to answer your other question, this is not specifically just for open source. Software bill of materials is for anything, really. So Cyclone DX currently supports it mostly focuses on software, but it also has the capability of doing hardware. So if you wanted to start documenting hardware devices, you could do that. It's not very good at it. There's a lot more complexity when you're dealing with hardware, but the National Vulnerability Database, it only has three things currently, and that's the vendor, the product, and the version, which, the Cyclone DX handles. So you could theoretically start documenting Intel processors, for example, and be able to get vulnerabilities against your processors from your bill of materials. But no, it's not specific to open source. Any kind of third-party component that an organization is not directly responsible for should probably be documented in a bill of material, along with where they obtain that.
And then Cyclone DX, the Cyclone specification, it's not really a piece of software yet, is it? It's just kind of the layout, the descriptor of what this bill of materials file looks like, correct?
Yeah. So Cyclone DX, it is a specification. It's currently in XML. I'm still waiting for JSON schema to be a thing. That's kind of 9 years in the making. So as soon as that is actually ratified, I'll create a JSON schema for that as well. Yes, it's a specification, but there are implementations of it as well. So you can create bill of materials from your Maven projects or from your Node.js projects or for your Python or .NET projects. And there's a few thousand organizations that are doing that today. So anywhere from financial services to software companies, to security organizations, to manufacturers, to some really large manufacturers that are using this today. So there's several thousand organizations that are doing this today, typically in their continuous delivery or continuous integration pipelines. I don't know of any case, at least to my knowledge anyway, where organizations are doing it manually. Everything to my knowledge is all automated.
We do have a question from the chat room from Roswell. How about support for Ruby and or Rails?
Hey, I accept pull requests. Yeah, that's definitely on the radar. Ruby is not my forte. Otherwise, I would have partaken it a long time ago. But Ruby is definitely on the roadmap. Dependency track. That other project I worked on, it actually supports analysis of Ruby. If you'd like to get involved with the project, obviously I do accept pull requests, and I'd be more than welcome to have a Ruby implementation.
How much code sharing has there been between the older project dependency track and this? Is some of the tooling based on the older project?
Yeah. So, I'm currently in the process of kind of integrating a lot of the core libraries, right? Dependency track was actually written in Java. I think Randall gave me some slack on that a year ago. but it's enterprise friendly. What can I say? But Cyclone DX, one of the implementations is Maven, and I also wrote a Java core module, and I'm actually using that core module, which does all the validation and Cyclone DX generation. I'm actually using that in dependency track, so there is some code sharing going on there. Absolutely.
All right, excellent. And then so we've talked a little bit about SBDX, not SPDIF, Randall, that's something different. Is there tooling to translate back and forth between SBDX and Cyclone?
There isn't. Actually, that's one of the things that the NTIA software transparency effort is looking at. They're not looking at Cyclone DX. I think there's some I think there's some other issues with the working groups there, but they are trying to map between SPDX, their BOM format, as well as SWID, which is an ISO standard. OWASP will never adopt an ISO standard. It's behind an ISO paywall. OWASP requires open source for everything, so that will never be adopted by my projects. But they're trying to map between SPDX and SWID today. And a mapping does not exist between Cyclone DX and Cyclone DX or as Cyclone DX and SPDX today. But I'd be really interested to see that. I know that I really encourage individuals to look at what their requirements are in terms of what types of analysis they want to be able to perform from their software bill of materials, and really look at the BOM specs themselves. SPDX and SWID both come from the licensing perspective. SPDX, Linux Foundation, has really focused on historically on open source licenses, so like GPL and BSD and Apache, and making sure compliance and all that. SWID actually has a background in licenses, but it's more entitlements. Am I entitled to use this big piece of, you know, some maker's software? That's kind of their background. When I developed Cyclone DX in 2017, I looked at the capabilities of the two specifications at the time and correlated that to what I was trying to do with dependency track, and neither one really met my requirements. So unfortunately, I had to create another specification. And again, at the time that I created it, I was just, you know, I wanted it to be independent of the project itself, but I didn't really anticipate the popularity of bill of materials when I designed it. That kind of threw me by surprise. But they're really starting to gain in popularity. Big thanks in part to the U.S. government, actually. Alan Friedman, who is actually leading this effort for NTIA as part of the U.S. Government, he had dozens upon dozens of meetings at RSA this year alone, just on software transparency and bill of materials. And a lot of the audience at RSA, some of those folks were supply chain folks. Other people were from security. Just a wide range of interest. So it's really interesting. The U.S. government is really helping to kind of drive a lot of this more talk about SBOMs in general, which I think is a good thing.
Well, I can't let Jonathan have all the fun, so I'm going to take the mic back over again for a little bit. But before we do that, we do have a very important message, because this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by IT Pro TV, experienced IT professionals who deliver comprehensive training at the click of your mouse. Spring is here, and there's never been a better time now to take advantage of their lowest prices ever. Purchase a standard membership, video only, for $28.50 a month. Upgrade to a premium membership, video plus labs and practice tests, for $42 a month. But wait, you can save even more. IT Pro TV is still honoring our special offer 30% off for Twist listeners. That drops the standard membership to only $19.95 a month or $199 a year, and the premium to $29.50 a month or $295 per year. That's less than $1 a day for a premium membership. You probably spend more on your daily coffee. Stream IT Pro TV's courses live and on demand worldwide. Chromecast, Roku, Amazon Fire TV, Apple TV, PC, or their iOS or Android apps. New content is added daily, so your training is always aligned with the latest certifications and the most current exams. Episodes go from studio to web in 24 hours. IT Pro TV is CompTIA's official video training partner. 12 CompTIA on-demand courses, CompTIA A+, Network Plus, and Security Plus certs. Visit go.itpro.tv/floss and use the code FLOSS30 to get started with your standard or premium membership today. Don't let another season pass you by without earning your IT certifications. That's go.itpro.tv/FLOSS and use the code FLOSS30 for an additional 30% off for the lifetime of your active subscription. IT Pro TV, flexible training, binge-worthy content, life-changing results. And we thank IT Pro TV for their sponsorship of Floss Weekly. And now here's the question that sort of raised when you talked about your specification being in XML. I was thinking that is so antithetical to the fact that you wanted a clean, human-readable specification for Cyclone itself. What do you have to say to that?
I wish JSON schema was a thing, because it would certainly make my life in the human readable aspect of it a lot easier. But JSON schema is currently 9 years in the making. So unfortunately, most of the tooling either supports draft 4, which is really, really outdated by now, or draft 6 or 7. Draft 7 introduced some breaking changes. Draft 8 has either been published or is about to be published. I literally don't know when JSON schema is going to be a thing, but I could have really used it multiple times in my career. So unfortunately, what projects like mine have to do, you have a choice, right? You can either take a really old draft, like draft 4, knowing that it's not compatible with the current drafts, and create a schema on that, because that's where most of the tooling support actually is. You could support every single draft of JSON schema, which is a lot of time, a lot of effort, or you could just do nothing at all and wait for them to actually deliver something. So that's kind of the position that I'm in right now.
Well, what does the text of your specification look like? I haven't even seen any examples. Sorry, I should have done a little research this morning. But is it just a normal text file?
Yeah, it's really, really simple and clean. So at the very top of the file, you have a BOM element. Underneath BOM, you have components. And within the components tag, you have a list of component. And component can have, publisher and copyright and group and version and pedigree and everything else. So it's really, really easy to use. They can get complicated. They can get lengthy, especially with ecosystems like Node, where a small application might have 5,000 or more components, right? But the schema itself is pretty simple, and that was on purpose to make it, even though it was XML, you can still glance at it, you can still understand it without having to parse it.
Yeah, a URL just got pasted in my chat room here so I can see. It's XML. Ugh.
Yeah, I know.
Why? Why?
If somebody wants to contribute some JSON schema for all the various drafts, starting with draft 4 and maybe draft 7 and 8, I would definitely welcome the pull request, because I've actually had quite a few requests for JSON. I'm surprised I haven't had more requests for YAML.
I was going to say all the cool kids are using YAML these days. So why is this not in YAML?
Exactly. Exactly. I would actually prefer that. Talk about human readable. But But yeah, I would, you know, the project accepts pull request.
And you know, the cool thing about YAML is you can drop JSON into it anywhere. If you're not used to getting all the indentation correct, it's actually quite cool because yes, yeah, it can be commented. And it's actually a wonderful superset of JSON in that you don't have to quote all the keys. So you just sort of put a key colon in the value in a curly braces. It's so cool. Exactly. My friend Inge invented was one of the inventors of YAML, and I'm really appreciating that now. That I think every new project should be only in YAML, but that's me being crazy. Are you working with a community to develop the software and specification here? I mean, or is just an army of one? What's your scope there?
Yeah. So initially, Cyclone DX 1.0 was just an army of one, right? It was me trying to solve a problem, and really, I did that because I had dependency track, which was trying to solve a problem, right? So I needed a bill of material specification that actually worked and could do the types of analysis that I needed to do. But Dependency Track itself is now a flagship OWASP project. It's used by thousands of organizations. It's competing against commercial offerings. And there's thousands of organizations using Cyclone DX today. So I'm the project itself is it doesn't necessarily have a standards body. It's not like a it doesn't have that kind of governance. It is an open source project. The it's going to continue being evolved as an open source project, but the specification is really evolving through both GitHub issues, as well as I use Groups.io for chat discussions. So some mm-hmm. of the things that are ongoing in Groups.io, for example, is whether or not we want to start documenting the use of functions as a service, right? Do we want to start documenting these things that are part of our application, but you have to make an API call to get to it? Or maybe it's a lightweight shim component that doesn't really have any functionality all by itself. Maybe it's just a component that actually makes this call to this remote function, right? Do we want to start documenting these remote things as part of our application or not? The other things that I'm working on are that dependency tree, right? View. So you'll have a simultaneous view of both assemblies and subassemblies, as well as a dependency graph as well in the same BOM, which is unheard of. I don't think any BOM format actually does that today. So those are the things that I'm working with the community on, because again, these are starting to be adopted by, again, big financial services, manufacturers, security organizations, etc. So community input is really critical now.
I think you touched on something I was going to ask about, which is that, okay, I have, you know, I'm shipping an open source project and I'm using Cyclone to describe my components. Do I also need to describe the components of the components, the subassemblies, I think you call that? Do I have to describe that as well?
Yeah, transitive dependencies. Transitive dependencies are things that are included through transitive means. So basically, you include a direct dependency, and maybe that direct dependency has a dependency on other dependencies, right? That's a transitive dependency. Yeah. Right. So all the Cyclone DX implementations actually handle transitive dependencies today. I think there's a few things that you have to do with the requirements.txt in Python, but other than that, you have to freeze the requirements text. That's what it is. But other than that, all the implementation actually handles transitive dependencies today. In the Java world and some other ecosystems, your build system may not actually know all the requirements at build time. So in Java, for example, you can actually have components that refer to implementations and the actual you'll have components that refer to interfaces, but you may not know what the actual implementation is until runtime, right? So your build system literally doesn't know. So Cyclone DX will allow you to both create them automated through automated means, but you can also then, because the schema is intentionally simple, you can then inject those things that may not be known at build time. You can inject those into a BOM after the fact.
Okay, cool. I'm thinking of things like, you know, my project requires Apache 2.4, and Apache 2.4 then requires mod Perl to run my code. You have to have some way of sort of developing that chain, and also then being able to do, when you're doing security audits or other sorts of licensing audits, to be able to know that it's including mod Perl, right?
Exactly. And that's what this effort is really all about, being able to have a really simple, lightweight bill of material specification that allows you to document the things that you're actually depending on.
Well, if the upstream, though, is using SPDX, wouldn't I need some sort of mechanical conversion from SPDX to my BOM?
That's interesting. So, like, I know in the Linux world, because Linux Foundation, I know SPDX is pretty popular in that realm. What's interesting is I know that some of the Linux distros also do a lot of other non-Linux work. And some of those companies are actually using Cyclone DX as well. You know, it's not necessarily one bomb to rule them all. I think each format has their respective strengths and different types of analysis. The vulnerabilities, the outdated component analysis, these types of things are really. I think Cyclone DX probably has a little bit of advantage over things like SPDX and SWID, which come from more of the licensing perspective.
Sure. And are there open source tools already to do vulnerability analysis based on a Cyclone bomb?
Yeah. So Dependency Track, the talk that we did just over a year ago. If I had to do that talk again, I would have pitched it a little bit different. But if you go to live and learn, right? But if you go to dependencytrack.org and scroll down about a third of the way on the page, you'll actually see a nice little animation of how it works. So you'll have a visual of the entire pipeline. So basically, you create a Cyclone DX bill of material through your build. So if you've got a Maven or NPM job or whatever, you create your bill of material there, or you can acquire them through vendors or whatever, and then you ingest that into Dependency Track. And Dependency Track is the thing that actually analyzes it for you. So it's going to do all the vulnerability analysis. It's going to be doing all the outdated component analysis, license analysis, etc.
And for those of you watching the video, for those of you watching the video, we actually have an animation going on the screen right now. I think it's the one he's just referred to. But if you're listening only in your car or something, you're not going to see this unless you hallucinate really well.
Yeah, I tried to describe this a little over a year ago on your show, and I think I failed miserably, but that's okay. I think a picture sometimes is worth 1,000 words. So on the left-hand side, you basically got the bill of materials generation, and then you can use REST or you can use the Jenkins plugin to push that to Dependency Track. And then Dependency Track is going to continuously analyze that for as long as you're actually using those components.
Cool. Where is this? Well, actually, I had a much more interesting question. Let me ask that one first. That way we ran out of time. I at least got the interesting question in. How did you get thousands of organizations to use this already?
That's a great question. So, Dependency Track itself is the project started in 2013, and it kind of failed miserably due to some things. I didn't have enough focus on it. But I rebooted the project in 2016, and in 2017 or 18, it became a flagship OWASP project. So it has a lot of visibility within the security community. A lot of organizations are actually using this instead of commercial offerings, which, you know, it does provide a lot of value, and the cost is good. Commercial things do have a lot of value as well. So I'm not going to, deny that. But because it's been a flagship OS project, and because the best practices of using it actually recommend the use of Cyclone DX, There's been a lot of interest in actually using that and getting the best signal to noise ratio. So if organizations were using cyclone or dependency track today, the best way that they can get the most accurate results is through using Cyclone DX. That's going to give them the most signal to noise.
Hey, Steve. Quick question. I noticed looking at the example code over here that Cyclone has the ability to bake hashes directly into the bill of materials. How does that work, particularly if you've got a dependency that's multiple files? Is there some way that can you hash all the files individually, you know, to get your SHA-256 or whatever, the hashing of the files? What does that look like?
Yeah, great question. So it really depends on the ecosystem. Like Maven, for example, Java World, you basically have a single thing, right? You have a jar, for example. In something like Node or whatever, you're going to have hundreds of files or whatever. A component can contain other components. So you could describe, for example, you could describe a component as being a library. And then you could have within that library, you could have optionally, you could have another component of type file. So if you wanted to describe a component that had 100 files, you could have the component being a library, and then within that library, you would describe the hundreds of files and the hashes of each of those files so that you could do certain types of analysis to confirm what you think you have is actually what you do have.
So that looking at this, that is exactly what came to mind. You could use this as a kind of a makeshift intrusion detection system. You've got your file that describes what you expect the hashes to be of all the libraries on the system, or you know they're a part of the application that you're running, and then you can just go through and rehash them and compare and say, well, have any of these been changed? And if something has been changed, raise the red flag and find out why. Is that something that's being done?
I don't have any visibility in that. I do know that is an interest. I do know that the folks in the NTIA working groups that I'm part of, that is definitely a concern of theirs, especially for DoD applications, obviously. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's exactly why hashes and those types of things are included in there. There are operational security aspects to that. There are obviously benefits to that. I'm an application security guy, so I just, you know, secure applications. I work with developers. So I personally may not use that, but absolutely, there's a lot of security uses for having the hash values there.
And then just thinking about this, it should be possible if someone wanted to, like, let's just spitball for a moment and say that Red Hat got real excited about this. Wouldn't it be possible for them to include Cyclone as part of their it used to be Yum and now they're moving to DNF for package management? Wouldn't it be possible for them to include that into kind of the RPM spec?
Yeah, that would be really interesting. I know that you can generate SPDX from RPMs, for example. I would love the ability to, and I've actually thought about doing it. I would really love the ability to generate a Cyclone DX bomb from a Linux distro, and then do some comparisons between the two. Because I'm typically focusing on the application layer. Right, not necessarily the OS or the Linux distro world. That's kind of been the realm of SPDX for a very, very long time, and I think they're really good at it. But I would really love to be able to have that Cyclone DX export from there, and then being able to do some comparisons between the two. What kind of data is the same? What's different? Why? Is one better for the different types of analysis? That would be some really interesting work.
Anymore, especially on a Linux system, people tend to use the package manager for a lot of the libraries that actually become part of an end application. So, you know, let's say we're running something on the Apache web server. Well, I'm going to install Apache using Yum or DNF, so out of an RPM package, and then I'm going to go and probably install a whole bunch of Apache plugins or modules out of RPM, and it would be, I would think, extremely useful for someone to be able to just run a command and say, okay, talk to RPM, talk to the RPM database, and tell me, give me an entire bill of materials for everything that is touching Apache, and then just, you know, it runs through and gives you this list of, in a Cyclone format, of everything that touches it. And then you just, you know, you can set that to the side and run some automated tooling that watches for CVEs, any of those things. I mean, it just sounds like it could be a really powerful system.
Yeah, I think so. I completely agree. Both from the OS perspective, I mean, you got Debian packages, you got Red Hat packages. Being able to generate that bill of material would be really valuable. From the application perspective, NPM is unfortunately the only one that I know of that actually has security as part of their package manager. Now, NPM itself is, well, you can debate the security of the repo itself, but the package manager, at least the modern versions of it, I mean, when you're using it, it actually checks your components to see if you're using things that have known vulnerabilities. If you go one step further, being able to generate that bill of material would be exceptionally valuable. Because right now it's just an optional thing, right? It's a module for NPM, it's a module for Java, for NuGet, Python, etc. That's optional, right? And I would love it if these package manager creators, these makers, were to include actual bill of materials into their package managers themselves. I think that would be a huge win for the security and license community.
Absolutely, absolutely. We're almost out of time. I was sort of curious about, in your time with this project, which has been a couple of years at least, you said, what's been the biggest surprise as you're developing it?
What's been my biggest surprise? I think the biggest one is really about the, you know, again, I developed Cyclone DX as kind of this sister little project, not really thinking it would be anything special in and of itself. And it turned out that SBOMs, software bill of materials, are actually a thing in and of themselves. I created an article on Medium. So if you go to Medium and do a search for software bill of materials, something or other, you'll come up with an article that I wrote a while back, kind of outlining the types of problems that SBOMs can solve. But I think that's really been my number one surprise as I'm developing this. I wasn't anticipating the huge influence that the U.S. government would have over this space and the types of conversations that have been a result because of it. So I give a lot of thanks to Alan Friedman and from NTIA for really pushing this effort. And there's other governments around the world doing very similar things. The U.S. is definitely not doing, we're not the only ones doing this. This is really an international problem. It's a global supply chain problem. So that's really been my number one surprise. Outside of that, I think it's the how fast the specification has really been adopted. That's really been the other surprise. I mean, if you look at the number of downloads for the various ecosystems and the downloads for dependency track itself and the use of best practices, it's really interesting how quickly the specification has caught on, which, you know, pleasantly surprised.
That's nice. That's nice. And in terms of resources, who do you want stepping up to the plate here and helping you out? What kind of things are you still missing?
Hey, Ruby, I accept pull requests.
We did that,
you know,
already.
go modules. Any ecosystem that that's not supported yet, right, would be a healthy win. But one of the things that's really missing is support for some of those unmanaged languages, right? How do we best tackle those? How do we best document native dependencies, native code, unmanaged code? Do we need a GUI to help individuals manage this? Because, you know, handcrafting XML is not sustainable.
Yes. Oh, gosh. XML should did not exist. Oh.
And of course, Jason, we talked about Jason, right? You know, if anybody wants to step up to the plate and contribute some Jason schema, that would obviously be appreciated. Is there a schema for YAML? Is that even a thing? I don't know.
The YAML description is written in YAML, which is sort of fun. If you go to their website, you actually see that the YAML doc is written in YAML. So it's kind of a strange bit of a meta reflection. So a little bit of inception there, I guess. Okay, now it's the hardest question I have to ask you all show. We're almost done. So you have to do set math. So you got to think about all the things you wanted to talk about, and then subtract all the things we actually talked about. And is there anything left in that set?
Oh, I don't think so. You know, for the C folks, for a lot of the things that, for a lot of the projects that the use of third-party components may not necessarily be obvious. Maybe you're embedding something or copying, pasted or whatever the case is. I think my one takeaway for those or piece of advice for those types of projects is really to start documenting in a machine-readable format like CycloneDX. You can use other things as well, obviously. But just start documenting what it is that that your projects are actually dependent on.
Cool. And two final questions, or my audience will yell at me. They actually do. They actually send me emails and say, what happened? Your favorite scripting language?
You know, we talked about this a year ago, and it's still
I know, but
Perl.
I didn't watch the show.
It's still Perl. Although Python is creeping up.
But Python's always creepy. I mean, creeping, yes. Did I get to say that right? And your favorite text editor?
I've kind of shifted to Sublime now. I'm using Sublime. You know, I pay for the little commercial version. So when I'm doing text editing, I'll do that. If I'm doing command line, I'll either do Vim or Nano. And if I'm doing a full blown IDE, I use IntelliJ.
IntelliJ, yes. I started using IntelliJ just a bit for my Dart and Flutter work, and then I realized VS Code was so much faster and so much prettier. So I'm basically now I'm confirmed now as being an Emacs expert and a VS Code not expert but getting there. So that's my two IDEs of choice. So Steve, it's been wonderful having you back and talking about this project. I hope more success with what you're doing, and hopefully you'll get a few people stepping up to do the languages that you haven't done yet. And best of luck to you.
Thanks, Randall. Thanks, Jonathan. Always a pleasure.
Thanks. That was Steve Spratt talking to us about CycloneDX. What do you think there, sir?
So it's obviously something that needs to happen. Supply chain attacks have been in the news enough in the last few years to kind of make it obvious that there needs to be a solution around this. And it sounds like this is somebody, Steve's going about it the right way. I like what he was saying about never using something that's behind an ISO paywall. Because if you really think about it, that's kind of anathema. It's opposed to the idea of open source, and it's opposed to the idea of letting people use it. So the fact that it's XML is kind of a downer. But you know, I was thinking about it. Well, do you really want to have an XML implementation of this and then a JSON implementation of this? But then does it really matter that much, you know? The difference between JSON and XML is sort of kind of more or less going to be what kind of curly brackets do you use?
Yeah.
You know, the actual spec isn't going to change anything. So, you know, writing a little parser to move between the two would be super, super easy. But just the idea of let's track all the things that we're using and you know, maybe let's write some tooling around it that goes and sees, oh, there's a CVE that hits this. You get an email about it that, oh, you need to update this before you get infected. I mean, that's just – it's an obvious win. And so I'm glad that he's out there doing the good work trying to get this put together so that the rest of us can use it.
And actually, as annoyed as I am at XML, I don't think JSON would be an improvement. I actually think if you're going to go to anything else, it should be YAML, because at least YAML it's a bit looser of a language. You don't have to quote the keys, for example, like you would in JSON. So I think it would be a better solution. But we're almost out of time, so I need to get started here. So let's talk about who's coming up. Next week will be a very special episode of Floss Weekly because we're not going to be taping Wednesday at 9:30 like we normally are. We're going to be on Thursday at 2 p.m. I've got confirmation already that Dan Lynch says he is staying up. He's a late night owl, so he's going to be actually doing that show from Europe at like midnight or whatever the time is in Europe. It's going to be Teleport and Gravity. Teleport is privilege access management for elastic infrastructure, and Gravity is opinionated snapshot-based Kubernetes packaging and management tools. Following that, we've got at the normal time back again, we've got RavenDB, which is a NoSQL document database. Following that is the Barrios, something backup, which is a open source fork of a backup project from Bacula.org, and it's in development since 2010. There's a lot of new features. Then we're going to have a representative from IBM, hopefully a technical guy and not just a sales guy. I didn't quite verify. A marketing person contacted me, so I have no idea, but I talked to them at the conference in wherever I was, East Coast somewhere. Or maybe it was Seattle? Well, I tell you, I go to so many conferences these days, I can't remember where I'm at. Anyway, it's a full-stack cloud platform, and this is basically Cloud Foundry. Oh, so it was a Cloud Foundry conference, right? That's where I saw these guys. This spans public, private, and hybrid environments. Of course, he's going to talk about the IBM commercial offering somewhere in the middle of the talk. I mean, that's inevitable, whether he's technical or not. But he's going to talk about how Cloud Foundry actually makes so you can host your own stuff, or you can put it on theirs, so you can put it somewhere else. You know, there's like a bunch of different companies that are offering Cloud Foundry interfaces now. CryptPad is a private by design alternative to popular office tools and cloud services. So everything stored in CryptPad is encrypted before being sent. That's kind of cool. The Redis people want to come back and talk about things that have changed in the last couple of years. So Redis is an open source in-memory data structure store. So again, we're going to have a couple of NoSQL databases coming up in the next few weeks. You know, I forgot to ask him about blockchain. Darn it. I just remembered. That was the other question I was going to ask. Does the spec incorporate blockchain? I don't think it does. Anyway, and just added to the schedule, in the last 24 hours, is Opsy. I met them at Scale a few months ago. It's an open source client management system to manage heterogeneous environments and enables the deployment and configuration from OSs and software on both Windows and Linux computers. So if you're in a place where you still have some holdouts, they're still trying to use Windows, poor guys. They were there. They were talking about how they can manage deployment from a central location and do that sort of stuff. So that's kind of cool. You can go to twit.tv/floss, which is the homepage for this show, and see the big spreadsheet link from there. Here's our upcoming guests. I think this is the name of the link. And you can see who we're working on. If there's somebody that is not on that list, please have the project manager or community coordinator email me, merlin@stonehenge.com. Like we normally do a live stream like we did today at 9:30 a.m. Pacific time on Wednesdays, except for next week. Next week is a very special Floss, a very special episode of Floss at the other time. At live.twit.tv, you can watch us behind the scenes, see the mistakes we make, and also just see the what goes into the sausage. Is that the phrase? Something like that, yes. How the sausage,
gets made.
How the sausage gets made, yes. So you can see that as well. And we did take a few questions from our chat room today. We thank Roswell and whoever else asked a question. I think it was like two questions. You can follow us at Floss Weekly on Twitter. So and you can follow me at Merlin on Twitter. That's Merlyn. I just got confirmed that I'll be at the Pearl Conference as press in Pittsburgh in mid-June. And I got to book my hotel and flights already for that now. It's getting close. And at OSCON in mid-July. So I'm press at OSCON in Portland again. And that's going to be handy because that's just a max ride away from my home. So rather than having to fly anywhere, get a hotel or anything, I'm just going to be home every night, which could be really cool. Anything you want to plug, Jonathan?
I'll mention when we're live about 30 minutes ago, my latest Hackaday This Week in Security article went up. So you can go check that out at Hackaday.com. And you can follow me at JP_Bennett on Twitter. And I will say if anyone comes across any very interesting security news throughout the weeks, hit me up and let me know. And your tip may just make it into an article.
Well, Jonathan, thanks once again for taking the second chair and getting things done with me, giving me somebody to hand off to and chat with in the private room and basically just making it easier overall for me to do a show. I've done this show as the only host a few times, and it's just not as fun if I don't have a co-host. It's a lot more energy drained. I'm really like spent at the end after a show with two hosts. It's kind of, yeah, I can still go out and do stuff. So it's kind of nice. So thanks once again, Jonathan.
Yep, my pleasure.
Cool. And we'll see you all again next week at the very special time on Floss Weekly.